This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services.
Welcome to the Rappaport Diamond Podcast, and now your host, Joshua Friedman.
Welcome to the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. I'm Joshua Friedman, Senior Analyst at Rappaport, and today's episode is about the Australian jewellery market. Craig Miller, CEO of Australian diamond wholesaler and distributor JC Jewels, joined us to lift the lid on diamonds down under. He explained to me what diamonds are in demand in Australia, how companies source their goods, and the success of lab-grown in the country. He also reflects on his time with the Young Diamondaires organization. Enjoy the episode. So welcome to the podcast, and it's great to have you, Craig Miller. I'm excited about this podcast. I've known you for many years through the Young Diamondaires, and the background to this is that we were kind of thinking, we write a lot about the US market, we write a lot about the Indian market, the Chinese market, but there's more to the world of diamonds and jewelry than those markets. So we thought we'd do a podcast episode on Australia. So Craig, you are really the first person that came to mind to speak about Australia. So I'm really grateful that you're on this podcast with us. And as far as I understand, you entered the diamond industry through a family business. Can you tell me a little bit about your background, how you got into diamonds?
Josh, thanks for having me on your podcast. It's an honor to have this. The last time we were together was with the Young Diamondaires when we went to the Venetia mine in Africa. And I'm a second generation diamondaire. I come from South Africa originally. It's where I was born. My father was a DTC site holder. I had the privilege of polishing on the bench, moving through all the levels of the supply chain. And in 1999, we came to live in Australia, where we set up a wholesale diamond business, supplying jewelers across all of Australia and New Zealand. The move was a good part of my journey because I arrived in Australia and I needed to build a network, and I did a lot of traveling. I don't think there's a corner of this country I haven't touched, and it's a beautiful country and I'm grateful to be here, but it's a very different country from coming from South Africa, where you have mining, where you have manufacturing. When I was in South Africa, it hadn't yet moved to Botswana, all of the production, and there was a boiling industry there. Australia is very different. The land was blessed with the beautiful pink Argyle diamonds, the Ellendale yellows. It's a different environment, but there is no manufacturing here and it's somewhat different. What I'll share with you is my journey from the last 25 years and where it's brought me to in the present. I think we're all seeing how this industry is changing, and it's changing at such a fast pace around us. If we look back at the last 5 years, nothing in this industry feels the same as what it was. As a diamond wholesaler in Australia and a pure middleman, essentially, I could see that, like many changes, the middleman is suffering, and if he doesn't make change, his future may not be sustainable. We are in a small country with a very small population. Texas, the one state in the US, has more people than the whole of Australia put together. And I'd come to work every day and, you know, we're warehousing millions of dollars of stock. We're giving memos, some long-term, some short-term. We're giving credit and extended credit. And by the time you've finished living in a country like Australia, where the cost of living is high, et cetera, I didn't see this business as being a sustainable model. And I wanted to stay in the industry. I didn't want to exit it, but I didn't want to stay in an industry where I'm not going to make money. I looked around at my competition in Australia, and most of the business owners in my space were north of 60 years old. I saw lab-grown as an opportunity. As mentioned, I've spent my whole life working with natural diamonds. I started looking into lab grown. I remember showing my father a lab grown diamond and he was disgusted at me. He literally told me to take it home before I eat dinner. And that reaction is pretty normal, and I expected that, and I thanked him for it, and he asked me why I was thanking him, and I said, because if all my competitors are close to your age, I've got a 2-year start with a disruptor. And with that, I had a vision of what I could do in my market in Australia, where I could grow my diamond business, look after my clients, which is hundreds of retailers across Australia and New Zealand, and give them a point of difference to elevate their game. And technology is something that's done that in all our lives. It's, you know, everything that's changed around us, a lot of it's been as a result of technology. So I engaged strategic partners, one of which is Stephen, who is a millennial tech guy, is responsible for our technology that has literally been instrumental in changing the way jewelers buy their diamonds in our country. He brought an in-house team to build technology, and we built technology essentially to transform us from a traditional diamond merchant to a tech diamond merchant.
How does it work?
Essentially, what we've done is we've used technology to solve some of our biggest problems, while at the same time completely value add to our client by working together in this new way. We took our network and relationships that go back 20, 25 years of independent jewelers that were traditionally calling us, ordering a diamond in on memo, on consignment to show a client, or just to look at to buy for stock, or our traveler would go into their store and show them stock and sell them stock, or they'd want long-term memo. We've built a platform where we give them a login. They have to prove they're a jeweler, fill in paperwork. They get an access to our website. Once they're in our website, we list over 500,000 natural and lab-grown diamonds. We have melee, layouts, shoulder stones, colored gemstones with certificates of origin. We have a full jewelry range. When our clients log into a portal, it's very rare that they can't find a lab or a natural diamond that they're looking for. When they find it, they have the ability to SMS the certificate, video, and image to their clients with their retail price on the SMS. It's quite a unique, I think we were first to market with that, but you'd be surprised how many diamonds we sell through such a basic method.
Who holds the inventory? Who owns the inventory?
We've got API feeds from probably 80% of the reputable growers. We've got most of them listed. We've got several site holders listing their goods on our portal. And the goods are listed in real time. If you order it, you get it.
How much of your business now is natural versus lab grown?
Josh, I work very hard to maintain. I mean, my dream results would be 50-50. But perhaps it's the demographic of our country. And at the end of the day, the consumer makes that decision, not me. My goal is to take my sales team and make sure that they are going into every one of our clients. We hold hundreds of hours of Zoom calls every quarter where we are training independent jewelers in Australia around the facts of lab-grown and natural and how to present them. Our motto is that the consumer is spending their money. It's their choice what they want. But what is one of my big priorities is that whoever is selling lab or natural side by side is educating that consumer, giving them the facts, the wins, the losses, whatever questions they have, and then allowing them to make the decision. And you asked me the question, it fluctuates what percentage lab versus natural is in my business. But again, I don't make the choice, but at the same time, we go to lengths to educate on how to sell them side by side by giving the facts and the education.
Right. So it sounds like lab grown has taken off in Australia rather like in the US.
Yes. What I've seen, I was a first mover literally for the first year as a dealer. No one else in Australia was offering lab grown, maybe one other company. And then slowly it started building up. I'd say from about 12 to 18 months ago, I would say that every dealer in Australia sells lab and natural. I'm not aware if there's even one or two that don't do lab grown. What I can say is America took off with lab grown, the UK took off with lab grown, and Australia has definitely entered that space in a big way. Only recently, New Zealand's starting to come on board. We're seeing a lot of growth in the lab grown space in New Zealand. As I said, my focus is to educate our clients, educate their customer. Let their customer make the choice. It's their money. It's their gift that they're buying. And I just think transparency and education is the most important part. But certainly Australian market, we're seeing substantial. I mean, Josh, it's growing fast in that space.
Would you say that that's because of a high cost of living in Australia and a general more higher sensitivity to price point? Or is there anything else?
Yes, I would say it's the value proposition that lab grown brings for the consumer. The consumer in Australia is not as hungry for diamond jewelry as they are for travel in many cases. I mean, Michael Hill does very well. Michael Hill's a good example. Prouds, Angus and Coote, all the chain stores. I'll give you an example. Josh, when I used to walk through a shopping center, it doesn't matter which chain store I walked past. You look through the window, you were seeing JK PK goods. You could see it through the window. They were trying to reach like any chain store, target price points, 5,000, 7,000, 10,000, etc. And fast forward 2 years, I walk past the same stores now and everything is white. Everything's clean goods. Everything's ideal make. It's black and white that those windows are now loaded up with lab grown and it's moving. The value proposition, I think, for the retailer is very good. I think it comes with pros and cons. And the value proposition for the consumer is something that resonates with the Australian consumer. I'm seeing that because I'll give an example. When I launched Lab Grown, as you can imagine, there was no one doing it. I never pushed anyone into it. I educated and I asked them to present to their clients, both, which they did. I tracked 30 stores. I strategically chose 30 stores and told them that I'm going to ask them questions each month if they're comfortable with it and I'd never divulge who they are. But I chose stores that were Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, South Australia, all our states. I chose stores that were metro and regional. And I chose stores that were the best middle to high-end engagement ring store in their suburb or area, most of which would have had a Bench jeweler and can do custom makes in-house. I've stopped tracking them when the 7 out of 10 engagement rings that went out the door were lab-grown. You know, essentially, it comes with pros and cons, and I can see why it suited a lot of these independent jewelers. Firstly, the way we've onboarded our technology, the way the jewelers buy from us, we've helped them because they can buy diamonds in real time. I hold a substantial footprint in wholesaling of lab-grown diamonds. And from the minute we launched lab-grown on our portal, every salesperson in my business was instructed that they are not to sell a jeweler more than one or two diamonds to hold in inventory. They are not to fill the front window and load them up with stock because we all knew the prices would have to come down. It's a new product entering a market. It's got to reach a cost-plus environment. It's going to take time. And during that time, I don't want to get caught out with stock and nor do I want my clients to, which is one of the reasons why we built our technology. So sales team were not allowed to sell stock to clients unless it was just one or two pieces. And as a result, I can confidently say that 90% of our certified lab-grown diamond sales were going into engagement rings that were ordered on demand and going into a ring and out the door. So I can speak for my few hundreds of clients that they continually thank me because they didn't lose money on the prices coming down. But at the same time, they were making very healthy margins as these prices were coming down. And at the same time, they were buying on demand, which meant their cash flow was very healthy. So the whole perfect storm had come together, which is why I can see the lab-grown part of my business has grown so much.
There's a period when wholesale prices have fallen for lab-grown, but retail prices haven't fallen at the same rate where jewelers can potentially make a nice margin. But from what I understand, those retail prices are now coming down as well, at least in the US. I obviously don't know what's going on in Australia. But from what I'm hearing from retailers in the US, it's becoming harder and harder to make decent profits in absolute dollar terms on lab-grown just because they may have made, say, a $500 profit per stone a year ago. They're now making much less than that. So you really need to sell volume to succeed. How do you see that going in Australia?
Josh, this is a very hot topic of discussion between myself and my sales team on a daily basis. Very important catalyst to what could bring a lot further change within our industry. You're right. They've ridden a wonderful ride and they've had great rewards from that. I am hearing what you just mentioned about the US. And I'm also trying to see that in real time because when I look at the online sellers, Brilliant Earth, etc., they are holding healthy margins there, Josh. The independents, you're right. We're seeing that drop. It's a big concern of mine. We're continually talking to our clients and encouraging them not to get into a price war. It has not happened yet in Australia. I'm monitoring our market on a daily basis because I'm looking out for it. We have a small handful of upstairs online retailers that's by appointment only that are doing heavy discounting. It's not a sustainable model. And at this point, the independent jewelers have not followed suit. And I get phone calls on this on a daily basis. Do you think I should, you know, I'm seeing these prices. It's coming from the same people that are doing it. Josh, I think if every jeweler in Australia can hold on to a certain margin that is healthy and avoid that discounting, they'll be okay. But if the discounting happens and everyone goes on a race to the bottom on who can sell the same certificate for the lowest price, you must understand that during 2023 in itself, I work very closely with a lot of my clients. I see their figures. I see which departments are moving and which are not. And when lab-grown prices fell and when lab-grown substituted so many natural diamond sales, their revenue came down substantially. I mean, this is simple maths. Their wage bills and their expenses didn't change one bit. And their bottom line profit was bigger than ever because of the high margins. Well, if that changes, and if that changes fast, I don't know if they can adapt quick enough. It is a major concern. And I have these conversations openly with my clients. So no, at this point, we are not seeing, our independent jewelers are seeing healthy margins. I see the chain stores are working on healthy margins. There is one or two rogue traders, but we are hoping that doesn't change.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA. Consumer trust is vital to the global gem and jewelry industry from mine to market. Through research, education, instrument development, and independent gem grading and identification, GIA is dedicated to protecting consumers, ensuring their trust in gems and jewelry, and helping the industry thrive. Visit gia.edu for more information.
Craig, you were an authorized distribution partner of WD lab-grown diamonds. Was that a major part of your business?
Okay. When our lab-grown business, when I saw the potential and where it was going, because we held such a substantial footprint in the wholesale space, my whole life we're selling on certificates and it's commoditized the industry so much. And I'll say this, WD lab-grown diamonds, I came across them because of the amazing work that they had done with the SES Global Services. The sustainably rated diamonds and the whole program that they put together was, to me, an amazing story of what the end product was. WD were 100% sustainably rated diamond grown in the USA. But one of the fundamental reasons why I came to them is they were growing as grown goods. And for me, I saw that as the premium lab-grown diamond. So I engaged them and we then became the authorized distributor for WD lab-grown diamonds for Australia and New Zealand. They were not involved in our business. We were just distributing. And I can't speak for the reasons. I think we've all read what we've read and I didn't choose to probe any further. But at the end of the day, I think that they were growing a premium product and it's very sad to have seen them leave the market. I think that they'll do great things still with the technology and everything else. But it was a pleasure to work with them.
So I just wanted to zoom out a little bit and look at the Australian market. We covered quite a lot of important points about it, but I'm interested also in just in general, in just whether it's lab grown or natural. What sort of diamonds do Australians buy? I mean, you know, there's a typical American diamond, there's a typical Chinese diamond, there's a typical Indian diamond. What's a typical Australian diamond?
Australia, in natural goods, for the most part, it's commercial goods. Australia is very much like the US. A lot of the majors or the chain stores, to reach their price points, are selling a lot of lower color, lower clarity. There's a big market in the natural for the JKPK goods. Then the independent jewelers, it's pretty much D2H SI goods, the Dream Eye Clean SR2. So the market for independence was mostly D2H SR2. And then you have your high-end independent jewelers who would be selling the F+, BS+. But it's very similar to America.
Right. You touched on this before, that the fact that there are no or few site holders, so the site holders come over to Australia to sell. Are these mostly Indians or who supply in Australia?
Most of the Indian companies are calling on a daily basis, WhatsApping, emailing, lists, etc. to the Australians. A lot of Australians attend the Hong Kong show. So that's where they're making that first introduction. It's close, it's easy to get there, and a lot of Australians are going. It's mostly the Indian manufacturers that work closely with Australia. And most of the majors, Michael Hill, etc., they've got strategic alliances and partnerships, you know, supplier relationships with the source in India. Most of them are traveling to India getting their goods. There's one or two site holders that have partner offices here or alliances. I'm not sure what the structures are. And there are a few companies that have now started sending over people that are being here more permanent or opening offices. And I think a lot of them arrive here and realize that it's this huge piece of land, Australia, but everyone lives around the coastlines. And to service business in Australia is a nightmare. You've got to fly right across the country for nearly 5 hours to get to Perth. I think Singapore's, if the wind's right, Singapore can be closer to Perth and Sydney. You know what I'm saying? So a big percentage of our independent jewelers are also regional. So There's a lot of travel involved, and it's not so easy to service a lot of the areas in Australia the way it is sitting in New York City, for example.
Right. Another thing about Australia that I've always wondered is, if you look at most of the major trading centers, they're within a few hours in terms of time zones. Israel, Botswana, South Africa are on the same time zone. Antwerp's only 1 hour off that. The UK is only 2 hours off. India's only 3.5 hours the other way. Hong Kong's a bit further one way. New York's a bit further the other way. But they're all kind of in communicable time zones. Whereas Australia's, like, you're a year ahead of us or something like that. Does that actually, how hard does that make business? I guess that's related to the fact that it takes such a long time to travel there. But how does the time zone affect the ease of doing business?
Well, thank God India comes online at about 2 o'clock in our afternoon and about 1 o'clock in winter. That makes a really big difference because that's where, you know, a lot of it's happening. We've got New York for the morning here and India for the afternoon. Josh, that's one of the complexities, I think, for Australia across all industries that has kept us so isolated in many ways, which I think if you live here, it can be a good thing in some ways. But Josh, it is challenging. And especially when we travel, everything is very far and very long.
Right. So there's a few other elements of Australia that maybe are less significant than they used to be, particularly the mining. Obviously, Australia is famous for the Argyle mine, which used to be the largest volume producer of rough diamonds in the world, but that closed a few years ago. And there's a few small projects, but they're not of great significance. Do you think there's any hope of a revival of the Australian diamond mining industry?
I think the Argyle mine and its beautiful pink colors, I think that the Ellendale mine and its beautiful yellows is a gift that this land gave us. And it would be really nice to find other deposits. I think there is exploration in the pipeline that we'll see what comes from that. The Ellendale mine, it would be nice to see that back online with the beautiful yellows. I've been out there and it's waiting to give us the gifts. But then there's the Merlin mine in the Northern Territory. Josh, I think it's a very high cost in this country to work a mine relative to some other countries.
Is there any diamond manufacturing or jewelry manufacturing in Australia?
At one point, from what I understand, and it may still be slightly active, Rio Tinto, when they were working the Argyle mine, a lot of the special tender goods were being manufactured in Western Australia. They were polishing the goods there. But again, you know, if you think about it, there's no manufacturing here. Equipment, everything else. I think it just made sense to export everything.
Does that raise the cost of buying, for a consumer, does that raise the cost of buying diamonds in Australia because everything's imported?
No, I will say that for the most part, and I don't have the data on this, but I'll make my own assumptions. I think you'll find that we make a healthy margin relative to other dealers in the world. It's not easy to get clients because Australians are very loyal, and as I mentioned earlier, you'd be surprised at how the majority of independent jewelers are buying their goods locally. They're not buying them from a site holder offshore. Importing themselves is very challenging logistically when you live, you know, 1,000 kilometers away from a capital city and there's higher cost to that. So they support the local in a big way, which is wonderful. Sure, a lot of people still import themselves, but it doesn't impact the cost to them.
Right. Fine. We mentioned at the beginning that we met at the Young Diamondaires. Can you tell me a little bit about I've gained a lot from the Young Diamondaires. What's your experience of it? How's it affected you?
Okay, so I've been, since I was with you on that trip, I've been on the Young Diamondaires organizing committee. We meet once a week, 18 of us from different countries. Rami and I, who sit in Australia, are doing it sometimes till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night with the horrible time change. The Young Diamondaires, for me, my business has transformed into a digital business. I'm a digital diamond merchant. I never in my life dreamt that that would be possible or how that would work. And I was even told when I started, if you look at Nivoda, we're very similar, but I'm only Australia, New Zealand, they're international. If you look at that model, when I took it to people to talk to them about it before I started, I was told that I'm lining myself up for failure. But when the Young Diamondaires was formed and when Rami formed the Young Diamondaires, I didn't know where that would go. I grew up my whole life. My father was chairman of the Diamond Club of South Africa with IDMA, the WFDB, etc. And I grew up seeing this culture that I just wanted to be a part of. And over the years, the clubs around the world and everything's changed a lot, just like my business. And what I like about the Young Diamondaires is that it's like being part of an organization in today's modern world, doing things the modern way. It's conversation, communication. You get insight into what's happening in the world. You have no idea how much I've learned from our WhatsApp chat group. When you guys post an article at Rappaport and it's got a lot of discussion around it, you've seen, it can be anyone who posts anything. It turns into a conversation. It opens your mind to the mindset in India. What are you thinking in Israel? What are you thinking in New York? The business developments that have come out of the Young Diamond Tears, I'm forever grateful. And there's a lot of people, hundreds, on the WhatsApp chat group. Some choose to be active, some not. But there's a lot about the Young Diamond Tears organization that I think is the modern way of being part of a community within our global industry and being able to reach out in a safe place, be able to learn in a safe place. You know, we go to trade shows. It's just wonderful. You've seen, we all just connect. And you cannot believe just from those dinners and other events, what kind of business comes out of that and friendships. So when Rami first started the Young Diamond Tears and to where it's come today, I think that it was an amazing concept for today's modern world. And it resonates well with this generation.
And just for those not clued in, Rami Baron, being senior at the World Federation, WFDB, he set up the Young Diamond Tears.
And it's quite interesting because the next generation, there's so much second and third generation in our industry. And this has given the next generation a voice. And I think that Rami has achieved so many great things on a personal level for me with friendships, as well as business and development that has come out of this, with people I would never have met and potentially never have done business with before. Not to mention the fun that we have and the trips, our trip to India, our trip to the Venetian mine in South Africa. Kudos to them. And there's a lot of organization that goes on internally. There's some amazing people on the Young Diamond Tears organizing committee that do that. Sadly, I've stepped down from that committee now. I've taken on the role of president of the Diamond Dealers Club of Australia.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I've just been voted in. And I want to try put energy into that space and create freshness and take that to a different level. And that's my journey right now. It's very new and I'm embarking on that now.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask when there was going to be a Young Diamond Tears trip to Australia, but maybe now you wouldn't be in the know.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure that'll happen one day.
Hope so. Craig, thank you very much. It's been a really enlightening discussion. I've enjoyed it all and I've learned a lot from this. So thank you for sharing your insights on the Australian market. As I mentioned at the beginning, we talk a lot about the US, we talk a lot about India, China, Belgium, but not enough about other places. So it's great to have been able to devote a whole episode to Australia. There's really a lot of points about that market that I didn't know and I imagine our listeners didn't know. So it's been very valuable. And I hope we will continue to talk, Craig. Best of luck with all your endeavors. Been great to have you on this episode.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for all of what you guys do. It's amazing. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you in the near future. Thanks for having me.
Likewise.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to get future episodes. For more discussion, news and analysis about the diamond industry, you can visit rappaport.com, follow Rappaport Group on Instagram and follow Rappaport on Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn. We also invite you to watch our weekly market comment videos on our YouTube channel.